This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to a Health Report special podcast extra with me, Norman Swan. It's a panel discussion recorded at the World Science Festival in Brisbane last year on the history and future of pandemics and epidemics. We were actually going to hold off on broadcasting it because it's out of date. It doesn't cover the coronavirus pandemic spreading across the globe. But for those interested, and hopefully that's you, in understanding the background and context of modern pandemics, still might be very valuable. We cover how diseases jump from animals to humans, how health authorities tackle pandemics, and the twisting path to treatments and vaccines. In fact, they're all key components to understanding the ongoing response to COVID-19. Joining me on the panel were John Epstein, who's Vice President of EcoHealth, Kathy Andrews from the Institute of Drug Discovery at Griffith University, Raina McIntyre, Professor of Global Biosecurity at the University of New South Wales Kirby Institute, who's been on several Health Report programs recently, and she's everywhere talking about coronavirus, and Peter Ann Zimmerman, who directs the Graduate Infection Prevention and Control Program at Griffith University. And Peter Ann begins by guiding us through some of history's nastiest outbreaks, like the plague in the 1918 Spanish flu.
Well, welcome to you all. Peter Ann, just take us through that timeline and illustrate some of these themes that I was talking about there.
Yep, sure. The first thing that we were going to talk about is bubonic plague. And this is the thing that most people talk about or think about when they think of the plague. So bubonic plague, there was actually about three different outbreaks of bubonic plague over history, even before the 14th century. But it was actually this plague at this point in time that actually had the most impact on the global population and travel also. The plague was actually spread via trade routes. So it actually started off in the Silk Road and actually moved from China all the way to Europe. And during this particular outbreak, there was about 60% of the European population was wiped out. Another pinpoint in time for infectious disease outbreaks is actually the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. This had a devastating effect. And when we look at pandemics or epidemics, we need to really understand, as we've said previously, how humans are actually interacting with each other and the environment at the same time. And obviously, this is around the First World War. So at this point in time, people are actually moving. There's displaced individuals, there's refugees, there's soldiers returning to their homes, there's even migrant workers. And so with this outbreak, what we did see was the travel of the actual infection moving along railroads. So migrant workers, for example, were from Spain and moving on to France at this point in time, but we also saw it actually being spread via ships as well. And so that's why island countries like Samoa actually had a devastating effect, with 25% of their population being wiped out during this epidemic pandemic. Okay, then we can come to another point, polio. Now, a lot of people talk to me about this and they actually say, well, haven't we wiped out polio? No, we've not. Polio is a vaccine-preventable disease. However, when we first saw the cases of this at the early 1900s, late 1800s, this was a time of great, again, movement of humans, but also increase in problems around the First World War. We had the Great Depression. There were a lot of people living in high-density situations as well. So we actually saw a number of people, or lots of people, and particularly children affected, who were infected with this, and it actually spread through the community quite rapidly. Even to this day, we are still trying to eradicate polio. There are regions within the planet, so for the Western Pacific region of the globe, as with the Southeast Asian region, we have eradicated polio. However, we do still have issues in conflict countries, for example, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, where there's been other issues related to it in regards to uptake of vaccines, but also propaganda as well around the inappropriateness or issues around vaccine use.
Do we know why? I mean, polio has been around for a long time, but do we know why we first started to really notice it in the late 19th century, early 20th?
They were finding that there were a number of children who suddenly had this wasting disease, and it's primarily seen as a wasting disease of one limb, for example, but also, you know, it affects the lungs as well, and there was an increase in this.
So, John, some of these infections we saw there, like polio, is a human infection.
Right.
So once we get rid of it from humans and there's no more cases, it's gone. Like smallpox, we hope.
Well, you know, it's funny that yes and no. It depends on whether these viruses have out there an animal reservoir we may not be aware of, and we're going to get into that tonight. But so many of the diseases we're talking about that are mentioned in this timeline that we'll talk about have origins in animal populations. And so when they become strictly human diseases and we eradicate them via vaccination and whatnot, then they may well disappear. However, sometimes we discover that there are actual animal reservoirs we didn't know about, and in that case, there's the possibility that they reemerge.
So tell us just this process of the jump from wildlife to humans.
Right. Well, it's interesting because more than half of the diseases we know about in people are zoonotic or have animal origins. And of the ones we think about as emerging diseases, those that are newly discovered or expanding in range, like SARS most recently, or Ebola, or back in the day, HIV, 3/4 of those are zoonotic, come from animals, and most of them come from wild animals, wildlife populations. So any given species of animal, just like people, has a microbiome, a group of bacteria or viruses normally associated with that animal, and it probably has, over evolutionary time, developed a long-term association where most of them are beneficial, some may cause disease, but if so, mild. And that's so often the case, is that these animals have, you know, evolved to live with viruses and bacteria associated with them. Now, when wildlife interact with each other through normal processes, whether it's predator-prey interactions or sharing food resources, there's an opportunity for the viruses from one species of animal to jump into another. And sometimes when a virus jumps into a new host and that immune system hasn't seen it before, you get severe disease. It could even be fatal. Now, when we see outbreaks in wildlife, or I should say when outbreaks happen in wildlife, we almost never notice because we're just not paying attention.
And why is it mostly viruses and not bacteria? Because Vaccinia pestis is a bacterial infection. But most of the things we're really scared of are viruses. Why?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we're going to be talking about bacteria, viruses, parasites tonight. But most of the emerging diseases tend to be viruses, and that's because viruses evolve very quickly. They have the ability to mutate quickly, particularly the types of viruses we see that jump from animals into people. And so there's lots of opportunity for these viruses to emerge, more so than, say, bacteria or parasites that are a bit more stable at a genetic level.
I'll probably add something to that as well. So I work on malaria, which is a parasitic disease, and we've seen...
What's the difference between a parasite and a virus?
Quite a lot. Parasites are probably much more complicated than viruses, but they don't change quite as quickly. So you don't have these massive changes that can lead to different strains emerging. But one of the problems with parasites is we can't sometimes diagnose them very well. So in the case of malaria, we're finding that we have monkey malaria parasites now being present in humans. And part of the problem is we really can't sometimes tell the difference between the monkey parasite and the human parasite. So this is a problem for us because sometimes these monkey parasites are actually a little bit more severe in terms of the clinical malaria that you get. So it does happen with other diseases
We'll come to this a bit later, but while you're talking about it, my understanding is that some of the reemergence of malaria in places where you thought it was under control, it's the monkey malaria that's come back.
Yeah, so it's all to do with interactions with animals and humans. And so where you have a situation where you may have deforestation, so trees being cut down and people moving into habitats where monkeys are normally the king of the jungle, I guess you could say, then you have this potential interaction between the monkeys and the humans. So you have the opportunity for an organism to cross over if it has the capability to do so.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example and a great point about how these viruses emerge. So starting out by talking about the fact that so many of them make their start in wildlife, I think a really important message is that this isn't wildlife's fault. It's really human activities that are responsible for the majority of these epidemics starting. And so when you think about the interactions between wild animals and livestock, farming, putting farms next to forested areas gives opportunity for wild animals and domestic animals to interact or even directly with people. Activities like hunting and particularly deforestation that gives us access to parts of the planet that are normally forested and perhaps less accessible, suddenly people and wildlife are coming into contact more frequently.
And if you go back 10,000 years, the creation of agriculture is probably the environment in which measles, mumps, chickenpox started because you had enough humans together to sustain human infection.
And poor hygiene. gene, obviously, as well.
Yeah, you know, measles started out as rinderpest, which was a cattle, a livestock disease, and the advent of actually cities brought people together at high enough density that this virus was able to jump into people and sustain itself. And that's actually the second part of this figure. So this exchange of pathogens, whether it's viruses or bacteria, disease-causing microbes, probably happens way more often than we even realize. When livestock start to die off, we notice, because they're important to us financially and for our livelihoods. And certainly when people start to die, we notice most of all. And so that happens, and typically what happens is if a wildlife virus jumps into people, and those people have never experienced it before, you get a very severe disease, often due to just a severe immune reaction to this new invasive microbe. And if it's an isolated human population in the middle of a forest, then you get a flare-up of disease, but then it quickly extinguishes because it runs out of people to infect. So people either die or they recover and have some kind of immunity. And a classic example here is Ebola, traditionally, where you had spillover from a wildlife source, which is presumed to be bats now, and people getting infected either from other animals that were infected by Ebola or perhaps directly from bats, but it happened in remote parts of the Congo. So Ebola is very deadly. Sometimes 90, 100% of people who get infected can die. When that happens in an isolated village, then the outbreak kind of flares out. But what we saw in 2014, which was unprecedented, is that an Ebola outbreak began in West Africa in a place right on the border of three countries in an area where people were very connected, and human movement brought infected cases into urban centers for the first time in history. Now suddenly you had opportunity for lots of people to be infected and for that infection to sustain itself, and it led to 20,000 cases. And so at that second stage, when a virus jumps from animals into people, if there's enough opportunity for one person to infect another, the virus has the opportunity to adapt to a human host. And perhaps the most significant example of this is HIV. What started as a chimpanzee disease, simian immunodeficiency virus, made its way into people probably through hunting and butchering chimpanzees, eventually adapted to become human immunodeficiency virus, and now it just circulates globally amongst people and doesn't need an animal reservoir anymore. So this is how these things become human pathogens and become endemic. And of course, through travel, we can get on an airplane and be anywhere in the world within 24 hours, well within the incubation period of these viruses. You wouldn't even know you're sick.
When did you
be infected. Exactly. I've been here for 3 days, so I'm okay so far.
And I'm sitting more than a meter away from you, so I'm cool.
Yeah.
Raina, before we move on with this, why is there this pattern when a new disease or a re-emergent disease hits, it's so virulent, and then it seems to settle down? I mean, syphilis was an interesting example, possibly brought by Columbus from the New World, a form of yaws, and it took off in Naples when there was a siege. And, you know, the Italians called it the French disease, the French called it the Italian disease. But it was a nasty, nasty, nasty disease. It's still a nasty disease, but not quite as nasty as they described it in the 16th century. Why is that? What happens?
Okay, so the first question was about why emerging infections are severe at the beginning and then tend to become milder. Partly it's because populations develop immunity. That's particularly true with viral diseases. And partly it's because we figure out disease control mechanisms. You know, in the case of syphilis, people figured out it was sexually transmitted, and, you know, use of appropriate precautions, etc., have then reduced the rate of syphilis, as well as testing and treatment. So once antibiotics came along, treatment of syphilis was possible if it was diagnosed early enough.
John, what's this concept of One Health?
One Health is really the recognition that human and animal health are linked, and that's really evident when we talk about infectious disease, but also that human and animal health is connected to the environment, and we have to take this as a whole. You can't have healthy people and healthy animals without a healthy environment, healthy ecosystem. And One Health is really an approach. It's a framework for thinking about health and also for addressing things like disease surveillance or disease control, recognizing that so many pathogens start in animals, make their way into people, and are influenced by changes in the environment. It's our activities that change the environment around us, whether it's urbanization or deforestation or agriculture, that really drives the emergence of these diseases.
We'll come to SARS in a minute with Peter and, but just maybe talk a little bit about how SARS came upon us and how this process occurred.
Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning that in order to really understand how diseases emerge, and particularly if you're talking about ones that come from an animal reservoir, you have to first identify the animal reservoir. So,
I should not just throw in SARS without reminding people what SARS is. It was just a dreadful respiratory infection, but people got gastrointestinal disease, and there was reasonable mortality rates as well.
Yeah, it's a viral disease that emerged in 2002 in southern China, but quickly spread to 26 different countries. So it really was the first pandemic of the 21st century, and it all started with bats. But we didn't know that at the time. Usually when we first discover diseases, it's because it's causing human outbreaks. And it's really when you start to look and you ask questions about where did this disease come from, you know, once you get a handle on controlling it in human populations, you need to know where it came from if you ever want to prevent it from happening again. And SARS is an interesting example. We haven't had another outbreak of SARS since the original one, fortunately. But what we've discovered is, doing some work in China, is that small insect-eating bats called horseshoe bats carry the SARS virus naturally. And so how SARS emerged in the first place was that China has a very active wildlife trade that brings wildlife into markets, urban markets that are sold for food. And bats are among the animals that are eaten in China, or historically have been. And so it was an urban live animal market in Guangdong that included civets and bats and other animals brought in from the wild and intermingling that allowed this bat virus to make its way into people and civets. And initially, civets, which are kind of weasel-like animals, were blamed as the source of SARS incorrectly. So there's a very public display of wiping out civets and exterminating them from markets. But we found that it was these bats that were carrying them normally. Now, what's interesting is there hasn't been another SARS case, but we've continued to do research looking at SARS viruses in bats in the wild in China. And we have found caves in southern China where horseshoe bats continue to carry the SARS virus and different genetic varieties of SARS-like viruses. And people hunt and eat those bats. So even today, there is the potential for SARS to reemerge. And we wouldn't know that if we hadn't looked in animals.
Peter, you think SARS was a turning point in terms of control of pandemics?
Yeah, I do. In regards to, you know, prior to the SARS outbreak or issue, we already had international health regulations from the World Health Organization, but it's through that collaborative work that came out of SARS. It was a turning point for all agencies around the world to actually come together to identify the virus very rapidly and to actually bring groups of people, specialists from around the world, to actually deal with this and prevent the transmission from occurring. And it is since then that we have been able to move ahead, and now things like, you know, healthcare associated infection control has now become an issue and a centre itself within the WHO to actually improve healthcare associated infection. And it is because
people picked it up off the ends of the bed. I mean,
it was
on the surface of doors and so on.
That's exactly right. And because this disease was amplified in healthcare settings because of poor infection control, because of poor cleaning, because of poor infrastructure within the facilities themselves. So the environment wasn't being cleaned, staff weren't wearing personal protective equipment, or they may have been wearing too much personal protective equipment, because too much can also be just as bad as too little. And so it was amplified in a healthcare setting. Healthcare workers got unwell and became very, very sick. We also identified how it was spread through the use of oxygen therapy and nebulized medications and the distance that needed to be between patients so that transmission wouldn't occur. So we learn a lot about healthcare-associated infections from an outbreak perspective with this as well, but it also brought a number of agencies together to work like they'd never done before.
Yeah. And yet, Raina, we get Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, which is a version of, it's a related virus, coronavirus.
It's actually got a higher mortality rate than SARS. So SARS was about 12.5%, MERS coronavirus is about 26% death rate. But it's behaved very differently to SARS. So SARS was a classic epidemic disease. You know, we talked earlier about epidemic versus endemic. It came and went in 8 months and it was gone, and it peaked really rapidly and then tailed off, whereas MERS coronavirus is much less infectious than SARS, but has sort of puttered along at this low rate for several years now, and it actually hasn't spread through the Hajj, you know.
Well,
that's
a myth, is it?
You would expect it to if it had epidemic characteristics. Like with SARS, everywhere that it spread, it set off satellite epidemics. But with MERS coronavirus, except for South Korea, which had a massive epidemic when a person who'd traveled to the Middle East came to South Korea, except for South Korea, there's been no epidemics anywhere else where there have been isolated cases through travel. So it's a very puzzling disease. And
could it break out?
It could mutate and become more infectious. And the pattern's very odd because it's really been largely contained to the Arabian Peninsula, and there's been sporadic cases in people who've travelled to other countries. But it hasn't had the same pattern as SARS.
Can I add something to that? Yeah, MERS is an interesting story because that's linked to animals as well. It turns out camels are the source of infection for people. And so while you get these sporadic outbreaks in the Arabian Peninsula, when you look in dromedary camels specifically, the one-humped camels, they are almost universally infected with MERS coronavirus. So this appears to be a virus that has been circulating in dromedaries for quite a long time and was recently discovered and is spilling over, jumping into people. So about half of the MERS cases, the primary MERS cases, have a history of close contact with camels, and camels are, of course, really important socially in the Middle East.
What about Australian camels?
The one part of the world where camels are not infected with MERS is here in Australia. So you guys are off the hook.
There's not many in Brisbane either.
No, that's true.
So just be aware.
You know, it's interesting. We're spending a lot of time talking about drugs and vaccines, which are really important tools for combating disease and for eradication, essential. But I want to make the point, too, that we're better off, because it's so challenging to develop therapeutics and vaccines, and quite frankly takes a long time, we're better off preventing these outbreaks from happening in the first place, which is why we talk about understanding the source of these epidemics, because if we can understand what animals are carrying and the diversity of viruses and bacteria and parasites that have the potential to jump from wild animal populations into people, and if we can understand the processes by which those happen, the type of human activities that bring us into contact with animals, we actually stand to do much better just living with animals in a smarter way, preventing these pathogens from making the jump in the first place. And prevention, the ounce of prevention, can really make a huge difference. And so we're inevitably going to still experience outbreaks and epidemics. So we need to be able to develop vaccines and drugs, but it's a constant arms race. It's a constant battle. And I think we really have to think about...
So is it possible to actually cohabit with the animals more satisfactorily? I mean, the response is often murdering the animals.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the wrong approach. I mean, it's so important to understand that we need wildlife, and biodiversity is actually good for our health. All of these animals that we talk about in wildlife, whether it's different bats or even rodents or primates and birds, all of these are part of healthy ecosystems, and they perform services that are important for clean water, clean air, for dispersing seeds. So fruit bats, for example, are really important at pollinating trees and spreading seeds around. So they help rainforest maintain itself. So without them, we'd be in trouble. But we do have to recognize that it's things we're doing that bring us into contact, and we can do things smarter. It's not realistic to stop raising livestock to feed human populations, nor is it probably realistic for societies dependent on hunting to just stop that with no alternative. However, recognizing that there are risks involved in, say, butchering animals, trying to improve on knowledge and hygiene and identifying some of those risky behaviors can really reduce risk and perhaps stop some of these outbreaks from occurring.
Did we learn anything from the Ebola outbreak in 2014, Raina?
The world was very unprepared, and the response, you know, has been roundly criticised from all quarters. I think it's fair to say that MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, were the main responder for most of the epidemic, and they were actually dealing with it very well. But the rest of the agencies really didn't do a very good job, and it's partly because it was an unprecedented epidemic, as you said, John. It had never occurred in West Africa before, so the people there didn't know anything about it. If you saw the movie Blood Diamond, that was set in Sierra Leone. So it's an area that's rich in natural resources, but very poor, among the poorest countries in the world, with very low numbers of healthcare workers, very weak health systems, very porous borders. And I think we learnt a lot of things. One, about that, you know, you don't just sit around hoping for a drug or a vaccine. There are lots of other things you can do, like just isolate people. Mm-hmm. So from March, when they identified the epidemic, to September, there was no disease control goal. Nobody said, this is what we need to do. They were just writing about it and saying how bad it was. And then a person from the US published a paper, a modelling paper, showing that if you isolated 70% of patients, because people were just dying on the streets, they didn't have hospital beds, they couldn't isolate people. So he showed that if you isolated 70% of patients, you could control the epidemic. So then months later in September, that became the disease control goal. You had all the responding militaries coming in. They built field hospitals, tent hospitals, and immediately increased the capacity to isolate patients. And that's what controlled the epidemic in the end. I think one of the other big lessons was about not being health-centric. You know, when we do pandemic planning, all we do is think about health. But most of what goes wrong during pandemics is not about health, it's about other systems, it's about other responding agencies, whether it's law enforcement, because usually there will be problems with law and order and law enforcement need to be involved, or militaries, as we saw in Ebola. The militaries are really important, local and foreign militaries.
Or customs.
Yeah, that was a huge issue, because that's the other good lesson, is that everyone reverted back to pandemic influenza pandemic planning, because that's all we know, when in actual fact we don't need to worry about burial or waste disposal with influenza. But these were big issues with Ebola, and you know, in the US there were companies that were refusing to transport the waste. In some states it was actually illegal to incinerate waste, which is the best way to get rid of that kind of hazardous waste. So it was a and then the cultural issues is the other big lesson. Yep. You know, there was a responding team that went to Guinea, Western people, health promotion and social research experts who went to Guinea to help, and when they came to the village they were murdered. You know, because the locals there didn't trust foreigners. They thought foreigners were bringing the disease right to them, and so there was a huge failure of communication and engagement and sort of working with local communities. So I think people learnt a lot.
And Ebola is a good story, because in the wake of the West Africa outbreak, it really prompted the world to think about an Ebola vaccine. And there had been lots of experimental vaccines that kind of died at the university research level and never got produced. And suddenly the World Health Organization said, right, we need one now. And there's now a vaccine against Ebola, and there's now an Ebola outbreak happening in DRC.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, which doesn't sound very nice.
It's horrible, because unlike West Africa, it's happening in an area that has ongoing violence. So what good is a vaccine if you can't deliver it? And that's the challenge now that we're facing with this Ebola outbreak, is that they're vaccinating people, but healthcare workers can't get to the areas affected because of violence. Healthcare workers are being attacked and killed. Ebola treatment centers are being burned down. So this is really difficult to control in a different way than West Africa.
So how bad is it, and what's the potential for much wider spread from Central Africa?
It's bad because it's happening in urban areas also in this region. Now, smaller cities than the capitals of West Africa, but nonetheless, people are moving. There's uncontrolled human movement. There's concern that it will cross from DRC into Uganda and other countries, although there's border control kind of ready and waiting. But all it takes is for people to move into different countries and healthcare systems, and it quickly can spiral. So I think there's real concern that it's not being controlled. Isolation is very effective, but that's just not been possible yet.
Peter Ann, do you think that authorities understand this conjunction of environmental change, social change, economic health, and biology?
I think there's a better understanding now, because thanks to the One Health philosophy that we do have, this is now being adopted by countries and governments around the world. It's, you know, what the WHO or World Health Organization are trying to encourage all governments to actually engage with, and all agencies to engage with. And so I think the social aspect is more important and becoming more important as we move on in time, because every time we have refugee issues or, you know, grouping trafficking of mass gatherings around this, or conflict, or movement of people from one area to another, that movement also includes movement of infectious disease. And so the agencies who are there to support these groups have to be able to mobilise to be able to prevent that from happening. We saw it with the Rohingya moving out of Bangladesh, into Bangladesh, sorry, with you know, massive outbreaks of cholera.
So, John, put that to one side. How do we do the predictive stuff here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is some good news, and I think if we have the hotspots map, you know, the ultimate aim for natural epidemics is to be able to get ahead of them. We're historically caught on our back feet. We're always caught by surprise. One of the political problems from the U.S. standpoint with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa was that there was a lot of money channeled to controlling Ebola, and then when it started to get under control and Zika virus emerged, all that money went away from preparing for Ebola and got focused on Zika. So we're constantly just reacting. But what you're looking at here is a map that identifies it's a statistical analysis of all disease emergence. This was work that was done by EcoHealth Alliance. And we looked at all past initial emergence events and looked at the factors that led to their emergence. And this shows you which parts of the world are particularly vulnerable to zoonotic diseases emerging, diseases coming from animals into human populations.
And why is it so focused on the equatorial and tropical belt?
Well, it's probably no surprise, and it's probably intuitive, that a lot of what drives disease emergence are things like human population density and biodiversity. If we talk about pathogens emerging from different wild animal species, parts of the world that have more wild animal species, more variety of them, are potentially more likely to have emergence, but you need to have a catalyst, and that catalyst is environmental change. And so one-third of all emerging diseases is driven by land use change. That could be deforestation or urbanization, any kind of conversion that impacts how we interact with animals. So that's part of this equation. So in terms of predicting or trying to forecast which epidemics are going to happen or where, we're getting better at understanding where. We're getting a lot better at understanding how they happen, which are the processes by which pathogens jump from animals into people. What still remains a big challenge is figuring out when and specifically what. And I'd say one of the biggest challenges, perhaps the holy grail right now, at least in my field, where we're getting really good and the technology's there to start to characterize the diversity of viruses in nature. We have large global scale projects like the Global Virome Project, or a big initiative from the US government called PREDICT, which was looking in wildlife populations at the different types of viruses and trying to understand which ones were most likely to jump before they do. But what's very hard is we can't yet look at the genome or the DNA or the genetic material of a virus and know if it's going to cause disease in people. We still don't know how to really interpret the genetic information. We can get that information, but we've got to learn to understand that. So that's where the science needs to be, and it's where it's heading. I would argue that while there may be a vast number of viruses out there, some fraction of which have the ability to cause disease in people, there's a more finite or more limited number of ways that those viruses can get from animals into people. The routes of emergence are more limited. So if we start to focus there, back to that three-stage diagram, that first level of interface between people and animals, if we start to understand that hunting and butchering animals, or agricultural intensification, or urbanization, the processes that bring us into contact and the way that these viruses get out, we can start to focus on interfering with those processes, and we're going to be much better off, because it will prevent the known bad viruses from emerging and all the unknowns too.
So where does, you know, this vast audience here, they're going to go out and have a beer and just ignore it? Or what do we do as individuals in all this? Raina?
I think be aware and be empowered, because you have the power to change things. I mean, for example, legislation around regulating the kind of research that I talked about. We don't have any, there's no global governance, but people have the power to change things, you know, people as a whole. I really believe in the power of the people, and the more you know, knowledge is power. The more you know, the more empowered you are, that becomes a force for change.
What better way to end this fascinating and slightly terrifying conversation on pandemics? Could you please thank our fantastic panel? Thank you.
John Epstein, Cathy Andrews, Rainer McIntyre and Peter Ann Zimmerman on that panel with me at the World Science Festival in Brisbane. And to keep up to date with the latest on COVID-19, subscribe to CoronaCast. That's a daily podcast, crunched by me and Tegan Taylor, that's all about answering your questions on coronavirus. Find it on the Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.